Thanks, all of you, for coming. Particularly looking forward to our exchanges. And it looks like we'll have some substantial time for it. And I'm still suffering from a bit of jet lag coming from New York, so I apologize in advance for how this may or may not affect my presentation. As you may know, we're in presidential debate season in the U.S., and watching the news each day provides a new lesson on how to keep expectations low. So there's my attempt. So before talking about abortion, let me just say something about religious and secular interaction in general. And if I can offer my own experience, I hope you'll permit me to do that. In America, we have both robust religious and robust secular discourses trying to work things out in our public spheres. I come to these discussions specifically as a Christian ethicist who wants to speak on the most controversial issues in bioethics and ethics more generally. Some of my colleagues are very pessimistic about the possibility of such interaction, and with good reason. Our culture is more polarized now than at any time since our Civil War, and divides largely along secular and religious approaches much of the time. But I'm actually more hopeful than many about this kind of interaction, especially given my recent interactions with Julian's mentor, Peter Singer. I've actually come to know Peter Singer rather well. I've debated Peter and lectured in his classes at Princeton. Last year, he came to my doctoral seminar in bioethics at Fordham, and he came to dinner with some of us afterwards, which was kind of fun, too, to interact. It was a little bit difficult finding vegan options in the old school Little Italy in the Bronx, but we managed to do it. Peter and I planned a major international conference together at Princeton, trying to find common ground and ways to talk together about abortion. And next month, he will join a panel at Fordham that I put together, which puts him and I in conversation with a diverse group of Christian theologians about non-human animals, which I'm really looking forward to. On the basis of these and other experiences, I want to argue that religious and secular discourse can go a million times better if the following three things can happen. First, religious folks, like myself, need to acknowledge the critiques that often come from secular folks that our arguments rest on first principles for which we simply do not have arguments. They grab us or claim us by some kind of authority. They are based on faith. Second, secular folks need to acknowledge the critique that often comes from theologians that their arguments also rest on first principles for which they do not have arguments. They also simply grab or claim them by some kind of authority. Whether it is the utilitarian dogma that one person counts as one and none more than one, or the supreme libertarian doctrine of personal freedom and autonomy, or even simply general claims that we can recognize flourishing and well-being at all. These ideas come from a fundamental understanding of the good for which there simply cannot be arguments. They come from a narrative, a story, an intuition, an a priori commitment. In short, they are also based on faith. Third, armed with the knowledge that both religious and secular folks have faith-based understandings of the good, if we take the time and intellectual solidarity with each other, we can map out places where we agree and disagree. And my experience is that we often find the agreement is quite substantial. I would argue, though it would take longer to make the argument, I would assert, I guess, for now, that it is in particular because understandings of the good, even in our secular discourse, are indebted to the Abrahamic religions for much of what they believe about the good. We can talk about that in question and answer if you like. This is an especially promising methodology, however, when we can find a way to talk in similar ways about where we agree about flourishing and well-being. And Julie and I are trying to work on a paper together on this right now, actually. It's slow going, but we're working on it together. At any rate, I found precisely this kind of substantial agreement in my systematic exploration of the thoughts of Peter Singer when combining them or comparing them with Christian ethics. In some ways, it is sad that this series will focus on abortion and euthanasia alone, because even though there is broad overlap in the premises of our arguments with these two issues, the ultimate conclusions are, in fact, quite different. But on issues like ethical concern for non-human animals and for poverty, for instance, the striking overlap is both with regard to premises and with ultimate conclusions. If you'd like to know more of what I think about those, I have a book that I just wrote out. But let's turn to abortion, and I will use my interaction with Peter Singer as sort of a hermeneutic to both outline my argument and show the possibility of religious secular interaction. And let me say at the outset that I realize that abortion is not an uncommon procedure, and my argument today is not meant to critique the decisions of anyone here or the decision of anyone else that you may know who hasn't had an abortion. As we will see, abortion is a very complex topic, and we need to make an important distinction between an act's immorality and someone being blameworthy for committing a particular act. Lots of mitigating circumstances would need to be taken into consideration to move from one to the other. Also, at first glance, it looks as if abortion is a terrible place to start religious secular interaction, right? It is such a polarizing issue, especially in my country, and especially in the context of Peter Singer's thought, who not only supports abortion, but the right to infanticide. Though it's not unclear now whether he thinks it should be legally available, he certainly supports the moral arguments for it. While my tradition, as a Catholic, claims that even discarding an embryo is the equivalent of killing a person, right? It seems, why would we start here? But as anybody who has studied the issue knows, arguments about abortion have many premises, and done well, they are incredibly complex. So I cannot hope to do justice to that complexity in the time I have remaining, but I can highlight the premises on which Peter Singer and the Catholic Church agree when it comes to abortion, and then make a short argument about where I think they disagree. And it's quite a narrow disagreement in the context of this really complex issue. So both agree that abortion cannot be justified on the basis of a right to privacy, which is currently the legal basis of it being permitted in the United States. Both Peter Singer and the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops would like to see the Supreme Court overrule Roe versus Wade and have the matter decided by public argument and a legislative process. I think that's remarkable right there. Both agree that if the fetus is a person, it would be wrong to kill that person, all things being equal. Both agree that if the fetus is a person, one has a duty to sustain that person with one's body. In other words, both agree that Thompson's violinist argument fails. Both disagree with the unintended consequences argument about legal protection of the law for fetuses acknowledged to be persons, whether we are talking about the claims that such laws are unenforceable or they would unacceptably harm women or that it would create a far too intrusive government. All those arguments are dismissed by both approaches, though there are serious arguments. Both agree about a logical conclusion or connection between abortion and infanticide. Singer claims that the same thing which justifies abortion also justifies infanticide, while the church claims the same thing which prohibits infanticide also prohibits abortion. They disagree about which way the reasoning goes, but they don't disagree about the logical connection. Where Singer and the church disagree, unsurprisingly, is on the moral status of the fetus. But even within this sub-argument, there are a substantial number of premises that both have in common. For instance, both agree that the fetus is like us in that she is a human animal, a member of the species Homo sapiens. Both agree that there is no reasonable basis for claiming that an older fetus is a person and a younger fetus is a non-person. Even viability for both traditions adds no moral value. Both reject speciesism, or the view that a fetus is a person merely because she is a member of the species Homo sapiens, or the view that only human organisms can be persons. For those of you that are unfamiliar with the Christian tradition, that may come as some surprise to you, but angels were considered persons throughout the tradition, still are. And in an interesting development, an official from the Vatican Observatory recently said that he would baptize an alien if he had the opportunity, and the alien asked. Though they might have different, and finally, as an area of overlap, they might mean different things by the term, but both think the argument about the moral status of the fetus turns on whether she can appropriately be described as rational. Okay, this then is where the disagreement lies. But isn't it just absurd to think of a fetus as rational, right? If a fetus, it is no more absurd, I would argue, than it is to think of an infant as rational. I think Peter Singer is profoundly correct to claim that a newborn infant is no more rational than is a chicken. But there is an obvious distinction to be made between an infant and a chicken. The infant, if she is healthy and in the proper environment, will develop her traits such that she will become rational. The chicken will not. This, then, is the reason we should, in my view, we should consider both prenatal and neonatal human children to be persons because of their potential to be rational. And again, I'd qualify rational. It's not in the Enlightenment sense of rational. It's in the sort of medieval sense of rational, which meant the capacity to know and love God and therefore implied a relationship. So it's sort of, I would want to say rational and relational, but let's just stick with rational because both use the term. Now, what I've just outlined for you is the famous, for those of you that study this, argument for potential, and those of you that know about it probably know a lot of the objections to it. So let's just quickly go through them. Most of the arguments are reductio ad absurdum arguments, trying to give counterexamples to say, well, if you think that those are potential rational creatures, count as rational creatures, what about these examples? So Peter Singer offers one of them, and he says, the AFP, I'll just call it the AFP, argument for potential, can't work unless we are willing to consider fertility lab technicians blameworthy for rinsing spare spermanova down a drain, right? Because they have the potential to be rational, and that's absurd, right? That's not, the argument for potential fails that example. Let me give you two more. Michael Tooley, who some of you may know, is an important philosopher, also a proponent of infanticide, says that the AFP can't work unless we are willing to say at a future time where we have a drug available which can turn non-rational mammals into rational animals, thought experiment, we would consider animal control technicians blameworthy for euthanizing kittens, right? Because given this drug, they have the potential to be rational. I love analytic philosophy thought experiments. They just make my day. R. Altacharo says that the AFP can't work unless we are willing to consider me right now blameworthy as I scratch my skin and kill my skin cells. Why? Because in light of cloning, these cells that I'm killing right now have the potential to be rational, right? We could, in theory, turn these skin cells into embryos. But that's absurd. All three are absurd. And that's pretty devastating, right? All one needs is one counterexample to refute an argument, and then you've got it. But we have three to deal with here. But in my response to all three, I want to say that what is going on here is actually a confusion of two different ways you might understand the concept of potential. And it's an important confusion, so let me try to unpack it. Aristotle passed on to Aquinas and then passed on to the church the distinction between passive potential on the one hand and active potential on the other. A thing has passive potential. If a thing has passive potential, it should not be considered right now the kind of thing it has the potential to become. For instance, a tree is a possible podium, right? But a tree should not be considered a podium. In order for a tree to become a podium, it would have to be cut down into pieces. It would have to be acted upon by an outside force that would change the kind of thing that it is. It would undergo what I call a nature-changing event. By contrast, so that's passive potential. By contrast, a sprouting acorn is a potential oak tree, but biologists already recognize that a sprouting acorn is already properly considered an oak tree. Here, the sense of potential is active. There is no nature-changing event. All the sprouting acorn needs to do is mature as the kind of thing it already is. And this is how making this distinction helps us deal with the counterexamples. So whether we are talking about spare spermanova or pre-drugged kittens or skin cells, it would take a nature-changing event to make them into rational persons, right? They only have passive potential for rationality. They would have to undergo a nature-changing event. But fetuses and infants already have a rational nature. They just need the right energy, environment, and time for this to happen. They have active potential for rationality, and thus already should be considered persons, already being having a technical moral theology, substance of a rational nature. Now, the church is going to consider all beings with this kind of nature, including angels and aliens, and I argue in the book that maybe some non-human animals should be considered persons as a result of their rational capacities. But this includes not only all these, not only prenatal and neonatal children, but as we will see tomorrow, I want to talk about those in a persistently unconscious state, various persistently unconscious states as well, as having the same kind of nature. Such persons, because they often suffer, let's face it, in my view anyway, systematic discrimination and violent deaths, deserve not only equal protection of the law, but the kind of preferential option for the most vulnerable that the Abrahamic religions insist upon. Let me also note in passing that the AFP is also the reason we should consider other non-rational humans to be persons. such as those of us who were in non-REM sleep last night, or maybe who were drunk or otherwise intoxicated, or those who are even enraged or the mentally disabled. These are Homo sapiens that aren't rational, but they remain substances of a rational nature. Now, I could go on to another topic here. Do you want me to finish?
Got time.
One more topic. One place that I think both Singer and the Catholic Church fall short in talking about abortion is with regard to feminist issues and women's issues. Let me talk a little bit about that before I conclude. This is a real concern. The history of men controlling women's bodies is horrific, and we should be skeptical of any attempts which look like it might do the same thing. And again, this is a personal nature for many, many women, and I want to respect that. But it must be said, I think, if I'm going to make this argument today, that I want to highlight some arguments that many of my pro-life feminist friends point out. And one of the things they start with is that the abortion rights regimes in the West came into existence under men, and it largely suits the social structures which favor men. It is seen as necessary for women to function in society, but that functioning seems to be as a cog in a market-driven, capital-producing wheel created by men. Many feminists are also sensitive to how mere choice magnifies social injustice. So in this case, when sexual power still favors the male, and it favors the male especially in marginalized communities, abortion's availability and its expected use becomes a tool by which men exert power over women. Also, when women are not given the resources to care for their children, the access to abortion choice is not really a choice at all, but another form of coercion. I realize you guys here in the UK and Europe don't have the same issues with this we have in the United States, but given some of the situations of entrenched poverty that women find themselves, the choice for abortion is not really a liberating choice at all. Given this, then, it is hardly surprising, in the United States at least, that women are only slightly less likely than men to describe themselves as pro-life. This is despite the fact that women are told at every stage of their education that the right to abortion is essential for their flourishing. Incidentally, and this sort of compares interestingly, at least in my view, to the numbers overall, where we're going with this. In the United States in 1996, according to Gallup, 56% of Americans describe themselves as pro-choice and 33% describe themselves as pro-life. In 2012, 50% described themselves as pro-life and only 41% as pro-choice, which was a record low. So even from 1996 to 2012, the numbers seem to be moving in this direction. And actually, it's especially true among young people, among the millennial generation, who also dramatically support gay marriage. So there's a little bit of interesting confluence there, or maybe dissonance. But let me just conclude and get to Julian. Let's go back to the big picture. So Peter Singer believes in infanticide. The church believes in protecting embryos. But the whole ball game, at least on abortion, with all the complexity and premises involved, comes down to the very narrow and technical disagreement that I just described. This is an important debate to have, and I wish we were able to have it more honestly and openly, but I'm confident that we can move forward if we engage our opponents in the spirit of intellectual solidarity. And that's why I feel so unfortunate to engage with someone like Julian this way here today, and I look forward to hearing what he has to say.
So I'm very keen on this project. Some of my best friends are Catholics. I think that it's correct to say that we are all individuals, and these groups like Catholics or utilitarians often don't accurately represent the views of people within that tradition. So, for example, many of the positions that Charlie claimed that Peter supports, I don't personally support as somebody who's broadly a consequentialist. And as I said, many of my best friends are Catholics. They don't have the same position as the Pope or fundamentalist elements of the Catholic Church. And I think one of the important projects today is to try to find a consensus in that middle ground of people who are willing to revise their views and find common ground. So I've actually written a new talk for this as a sort of tribute to Charlie's kind of ideas. And it's one example of where I've revised my own views. And I think they're in some ways closer to a Catholic position than certainly they began with. But let me first give you the background to how I arrived at this position and then the implications. So in March, I will make some remarks if there is time on Charlie's arguments about potentiality. I think they're wrong, but I think there's a grain of truth in them, and again, a common ground that we can share. But let me start off with my journey towards reconciliation. In March 2006, a 21-year-old Cleveland man, Christopher Chalanson, was driving home from a party with his 17-year-old girlfriend, Jessica Karros. She was 4 months pregnant. They began to argue about her ability to care for their child. Chalanson, who had been drinking, became angry and began to weave at high speed through the traffic. He lost control of the car and crashed. Karros was left paralyzed from the chest down, and the baby died. Chalanson was unhurt. Because he killed the baby, he was charged with homicide in this state of the United States, as well as assault for ruining her life, as her father put it. So here we have a case where a man is charged with homicide for killing a fetus. In January 2005, Alison Miller and Todd Parrish sued their fertility clinic, the Center for Human Reproduction in Chicago. They had been having IVF in 2002 and had stored 9 embryos, one of which was mistakenly discarded by the clinic. The clinic apologized and offered the couple a free cycle of IVF, but they sued the clinic for the wrongful death of their embryo. Now, contrast those two cases with the fact that in countries like the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, hundreds of thousands of abortions of fetuses occur every year. The fetuses are killed, and these are not deemed to be crimes. Nearly all of these abortions are for healthy, normal babies. No one is charged with murder or negligence over these deaths. Thousands of embryos are destroyed in Australia, the United Kingdom, America, every year. In fact, the law in countries like Australia and the United Kingdom requires their destruction after a certain period, usually 5 to 10 years. So how can killing a fetus on the one hand be homicide and on the other hand no crime at all? How can the destruction of embryos at the same time be required by law and widely practiced, but also, in some places, be the crime of wrongful death and a moral abomination? How can one act, the killing of early human life, be both right and wrong? We have polar opposite attitudes, moral norms and laws relating to embryos and fetus. How can this conflict be reconciled? Now, one solution, which has been proposed by the Christian right, including fundamentalist elements of the Catholic Church, pro-life movements, and some politicians, is to give the embryo, from the moment of conception, a full right to life, to treat it like a child. This proposal has been championed, in fact, by the current opposition leader of the Australian Liberal Party, Tony Abbott. Now, the strategy of giving an embryo or a fetus a full right to life certainly resolves this conflict in the practices relating to early life. Killing embryos and fetuses would then always be wrong. But it also leaves us in a world with no abortion, even after rape or when the woman's life is at stake, no effective contraception, the most commonest methods, the IUD and the pill, both destroy early human life, no IVF, and ultimately no control over our reproduction. And this appeal to potentiality would create enormous problems for society, because the greatest loss of human beings occurs before birth. Huge numbers of embryos, 4 out of 5 embryos perish before ever producing a baby. If they were human beings, this would dwarf all disease that currently exists amongst existing persons. And we should devote all of our medical resources, as Toby Ord argues, to this scourge of early fetal loss. Now, many conservative religious and political leaders joyfully embrace these consequences. They seek to impose these values on the rest of society because they believe on faith and without consideration of any revision of their views to be right. This is just the sort of disrespect for liberty, intolerance and moral pigheadedness that we find so contemptible in regimes like that of the Taliban. Now, in Australia, our own aspiring Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, once wrote of the importance of Christian values in public life, and it lauded Australian Christian politicians. However, the kinds of Christian values which claim that the embryo and fetus have the same right to life, exactly the same right to life as other humans, accounts poorly for the way in which modern liberal society actually functions, and the conflict with widely accepted and valued practices. Now, there is a value to controlling our reproduction, to deciding how many children we will have and when to have them. Go forth and multiply was a biblical injunction, but there is a limit to that. Every human life has a value when it's a part of a plan, sometimes a well-formed plan in the context of a blissful, loving marriage, but sometimes an inarticulate intention in a chaotic or immature relationship to have a child is the wrong thing. And sometimes there are too many people in the world. The moral reason that Challenson was wrong to act in a way which killed his girlfriend's baby was because she wanted to have the baby. Challenson is more like a drunk driver who recklessly kills an innocent child than a doctor who performs an abortion at a woman's request. It should have been Miller and Parrish who decided the fate of their embryos, not the Chicago Clinic. No matter what the law, the destruction of embryos is a moral crime when parents want to have them. If they don't want them, I'd like to say there's nothing wrong, but I'm going to go argue and argue that there is something wrong, but nothing hugely wrong in destroying them. So here is the solution to the puzzle of our conflicting attitudes towards the embryo and the fetus. Embryos have a special moral value when they're part of a plan to have a child, or at least desired by the people who made them. Embryos don't have special moral value when they're not desired by the people who formed them. One of the greatest ethical advances has been to give people freedom to control their own reproduction, to decide how many children to have and when to have children. This is precisely something that the fundamentalist elements of the Catholic Church seek to deny, this reproductive liberty. Fortunately, women no longer have to have 10 or 20 children during their reproductive lives. So the two missing puzzles in the puzzle of early life are the value of reproductive liberty and the conditional moral status of early life. Now, the implications of the fetus or embryo having conditional value. I view the embryo or the fetus as like a work of art. Now, something like the Mona Lisa. It's wrong to destroy valuable art for no reason. And it would be wrong even to fail to produce that valuable art if we had no good reason. Imagine that Da Vinci was sitting around with nothing special to do one day and he thought, well, maybe I could paint something that will become the Mona Lisa. He said, no, I prefer to go to the pub and have a drink with my friends. This would be, I believe, a wrong thing because of all the joy that he's brought to future people through their viewing of that art and numerous other values. Now, he has a reason to produce that art, and we have a reason not to destroy it. But we don't have to ascribe an intrinsic moral value to the Mona Lisa to make those claims. We only have to appeal to its conditional value, conditional on its value to people who have been alive or will be alive or are alive. Now, it seems trivializing to value early human life and to compare it to art. But one could make the extreme claim that every human life is more valuable than the Mona Lisa. Even so, I think few people would accept that. But even if it were true, we're still not under a strong obligation to have children or to refrain from abortion in the same way as Da Vinci is not under a strong obligation to produce such a thing. Other reasons could defeat the obligation to produce such works of art. Now, when it comes to spare IVF embryos for couples who have already had the number of children that they want, we're faced with a similar kind of problem. Other couples want to use them, yet almost routinely those embryos are destroyed. This is like, in many ways, the destruction of a work of art for no good reason. Now, consider abortion. People bring value to each other's lives. And when a couple decides or a woman decides to have an abortion, she is in many ways denying future people who will exist the value that that child would have brought to their lives. This is most obvious in those cases where there's a couple who wish to adopt the child, but in more general cases, that child brings value to society. People like Derek Parfit and myself have even argued that there are impersonal values or impersonal reasons that have to do with reproduction, but we needn't deal with that difficult issue here. We can simply concentrate on the value that a child, a baby, a fetus would bring to the future in the same way as creating a piece of art or some other valuable object would bring to future people. Now, as I said, we have reasons to create objects, pieces of art, and also to bring into existence possible people. But this is only a pro tanto or prima facie reason or a defeasible obligation. Nobody would argue that we have an overriding obligation to bring about whatever value we can into the future. Clearly, this has to be weighed against other reasons. Reasons to control the global population, duties to oneself and one's existing children, duties to the environment, and so on. All of these obligations or reasons have to be weighed in order to decide whether one has, all things considered, a reason to have a child or not have a child. And given that the reasons to do with bringing art forms into existence or things that benefit other people are much smaller than the reasons we typically have to existing people, these obligations will typically be quite weak. But nonetheless, they exist. So in those cases where giving up an embryo or a fetus imposes very little cost on a couple, the reasons to give those embryos or fetuses up are much stronger. So, for example, if ectogenesis, the ability to gestate embryos or fetuses outside of the female body were the case, then the costs of giving up a fetus or an embryo would be much less. The costs are smallest in the case of spare embryos from IVF. So in these cases, the reasons to give them up are not outweighed typically by strong personal reasons that would argue in favour of their destruction. So in some cases, a few cases, I think it can be, all things considered, wrong to destroy embryos or even fetuses, particularly those which are spare from IVF. I believe we have obligations, not utilitarian obligations, but obligations of a duty of easy rescue. So one minimal form of consequentialism is to argue that when the cost to you is small and the benefit to somebody else is large, you have a moral obligation to perform that act. Now, it's interesting that Peter, typically, when he goes to argue in public, doesn't argue from utilitarian considerations. He argues from this consideration, which is much more acceptable to everyone. So his arguments about alleviation of poverty are based on these sorts of duty of easy rescue considerations. So it's clear that people could be, it seems to me clear that people could be under an obligation to have a child when it's a case of a duty of easy rescue, such as when it would be a matter of merely giving up embryos which are no longer required for reproduction to another couple who desperately want to gestate a child and have a child of their own. Now, this could even be a legal requirement. It seems to me that both conservatives about the moral value of embryos and fetuses and consequentialists such as myself, who see some value to bringing embryos and fetuses to the point of producing a live-born person, could agree that the law should require a duty of easy rescue. So, in my view, the law should change to require couples who are engaging in IVF, who no longer require their embryos, to give those embryos to couples who are childless and who want them, and also to give them to scientists who are doing bona fide research on the embryo. So, according to this argument, there is something wrong about abortion. It's not that it denies a future of value, as Don Marquis has said, because that argument is obviously mistaken, because if you have an abortion, there is no future child who's deprived of a future of value. But it's a variant of that. It says that you deprive other people in the future of the value that this individual would bring to their lives in the same way as you deny them the value that a piece of art would provide them. So there is something wrong with abortion, and there is something wrong with destruction of embryos. And I think we can agree that the needless destruction, the reasonless destruction of embryos as a part of IVF is something that's wrong, and indeed probably should be legislated against. So I think I have a couple more minutes, so let me make a couple of remarks about Charlie's argument from potential, because I think a lot of it hinges on this. And a lot of it, I don't want to make this a debate around potential and the difference between active and passive potential. But I'll make this one point. Charlie made the telling point that a tree is no podium because you have to do something to it. You have to modify it in order for it to become a podium. So too with IVF embryos. An embryo sitting in a petri dish is not going to produce a baby unless you transfer it into a human uterus. And that's a human act, a technological act. So I can't see, even if his argument applies, which I don't think it does, to fetuses and embryos that occur naturally, that the same argument would apply to IVF embryos. Now, as I said, I don't accept this argument because, as the recent research using iPS cells has shown, and he mentions Alto Charo, but I made the same argument myself somewhere rather than the Journal of Medical Ethics at one point. A somatic cell has a complete genetic complement in the same way as an embryo. Yet, as Yamanaka has shown, a few of those genetic switches are turned in certain ways. How can you say that there's a huge moral difference between an embryo that occurs naturally and a skin cell when both of them have the same genetic complement and a few genetic switches are turned the other way? Surely, if one has an active potential, the other has an active potential, because they're both the same biological substance. In fact, they're genetically, you know, identical to each other. So I can't see how you can say, you can make this argument that one has a passive potential and the other has an active potential. Both of them have the instructions for an entire human being, and it's a matter of chance, or a matter of circumstance, or a matter of evolution that the switches happen to be in one way or the other. And as I said, I think Johnny Pugh will have more to say about Charlie's arguments about potential, but as I said, the implications of this are devastating. If you really accept that we should give special moral consideration to embryos in virtue of their potentiality, our whole pattern of medical research and medical treatment should radically shift, because we have an epidemic of embryo death that kills many more people than die every year from any other disease. But I don't want to be intensely critical. I think that consequentialists such as myself, who accept the duty of easy rescue and accept considerations of value, and non-consequentialists such as Charlie, can both agree that in certain circumstances there's something wrong about abortion and something wrong about the destruction of embryos. How we should respond to that in law is a separate question. I think the revisions of law that are necessary are fairly limited. But I'll finish there and have discussion.
All right, so we're going to move to the first phase of our discussion, and we've got 10 minutes to take questions. I encourage you to stick to 1 minute for your questions at this stage, and I will hold you to that. Does anybody have a question which they wish to start with? Go ahead.
Yes. Just on the issue of potential and consistency, can I be consistently told that I ought to ensure that a fetus survives to adulthood because of its potential, and also be told that I ought to care about the welfare of future generations who may not exist at all? Because what I actually find is that quite a lot of exclusive humanists are very keen that I treat fetuses simply as, you know, nothing. They wouldn't agree with you that a fetus matters in any sense. and therefore the destruction of the fetus is not morally significant in itself. But they would be very keen to make me deeply concerned about the welfare of all sorts of people who may, or indeed may well not exist, many years after I'm dead. Is that an inconsistent position?
You know, I completely agree with you, and I should have made that point, that our reasons to be concerned about future generations are impersonal reasons, because the choices that take climate change, everyone says we should be reducing carbon emissions, etc. That won't benefit anyone in the future, because it will change the identity of people who exist in the future. That will make their life, they will have higher levels of well-being, but we're not benefiting any individual in the future. And the same with choices around whether fetuses live or don't live. It's not that we benefit them, we bring about an impersonal kind of benefit to the future. So they're exactly analogous. And for that reason, I think our obligations to future generations are much weaker than we typically think. We think of, you know, reducing carbon emissions in exactly the same way as we would think about harming an individual today. But I think those obligations are much weaker, and they're more like our obligations to find reasons not to have an abortion, to destroy the world.
Hi, next, Johnny.
We can see that the fetus has active potential, as you explained. I'm not quite clear why that should necessarily be sufficient for a right to life. Because when we ascribe a right to life to other beings, what seems to be important is that they have these actual capacities. So could you say a little bit about the relationship between the value that actual capacities have and why having this active potential should confer the same moral value?
Well, like I said, I think a lot of this comes down to intuitions, and it's trying to be consistent with our intuitions about other human beings that don't have actively rational capacities at the moment. So imagine somebody asleep, or somebody in rage, or somebody with a temporary disability of some kind. We could say, well, somebody's in a temporary coma, right? They're going to be in for a coma for a few days. Can I smother them with a pillow without killing a person? I'd say, well, no, of course not, because they're the same kind of thing. Even though they're not currently expressing any rational capacities or their kinds of capacities, they're the same kind of thing. They have the same active potential. And so I'm just trying to consistently apply that view and say, well, what other kinds of things have the same active potential? And turns out they include infants and fetuses, and I would argue those in a persistently unconscious state and other kinds.
Can I say something about this, though? Rationality has to be a dispositional concept. You can't always be being rational. So the claim that people who are asleep or in a coma just fits in with, you know, you are at that point dispositionally rational. But when it comes to embryos, they're not dispositionally rational at all. They haven't had any disposition to be rational, and in the future they will have a disposition to rationality, but they don't at the moment.
What do you mean, Zora?
Well, you can't say that somebody's a cigarette smoker by saying, you know, he has to be smoking a cigarette every single time you look at him. I mean, you're a cigarette smoker if you have a disposition. No, you'll be asleep, but you're still a cigarette smoker.
What if you never smoke another cigarette when you wake up? Are you a cigarette smoker?
Well, you've given up. But you don't claim that somebody is no longer a cigarette smoker when they're asleep because they're not smoking cigarettes.
I also want to think about the relationship between being a cigarette smoker and having a rational nature too. I'm not sure it's perfectly analogous, but I mean,
yeah, sorry.
Yeah. All right, so questions. Just got some time for more. Should we have one minute?
Yeah. So I was sort of interested in the distinction between obligations to bring about to bring some embryo into existence and the obligations that you would have to an existing person. It seems like maybe Mr. Kamosi just wouldn't be comfortable. It seems like implicit in that claim is that the embryo isn't already an existing person. And as you were saying, it seems like some people would say, actually, from the beginning, that fetus, that embryo, is an existing person, and that's at least one possible view. And so I'm sort of wondering what are the considerations that tell against that claim that that's actually an existent person, and so our obligations aren't just pro tanto, they're much stronger than that.
That's a debate around whether the embryo or fetus is a person. So what I tried
to suggest is that for most people, nobody takes that seriously. You know, that otherwise, you know, what would be going on at the moment is mass murder equivalent to what the Nazis did. So, you know, that's not something that most people, if they believe there's something wrong, but it's not as wrong as killing a person. Of course, there are people at the fringe, the pro-life movements, who really, you know, and that's why they go and kill, you know, people who perform abortions or, you know, even discuss the matter. So I don't think there's anything to be said to that group. Somebody says that as I think Charlie says, that, you know, at some point you have some premises which you have to accept, and if you think that, you know, if you just assert and you're unwilling to engage in any argument or revision, that the, you know, embryo is a full person from the moment it exists, that's it. You can't. I mean, there's nothing you can do to engage with that. But, you know, most people accept different premises. So I think that, you know, when he said, well, you know, people who have, you know, have religious views have these premises on faith, and so do consequentialists. That's true, but the premises that consequentialists have are pretty uncontroversial. It's like your happiness or how your life goes or how long you live. And most people can share it. Of course, they are just shared premises, but they're ones that, you know, we can agree on. Now, if you can't agree on the first one, no amount of discussion for the rest of the argument is going to, you know, bring about any. So there is no hope about bringing the extreme elements of the debate together. There's only hope about people in the middle shifting their view, you know, to some degree.
Can I just say one thing? I agree with most of what Julian said, but I can't let the claim that most people agree with consequentialist views go unresponded to. So most consequentialists, if you're not a sort of rule consequentialist, have to accept claims like we need to round up homeless people and do medical experiments on them, produce good outcomes, or the only reason we shouldn't do that is because in the long run we won't produce as many good outcomes. And so I don't want to have an argument about that particular case, but there are a lot of counterintuitive claims that true, straight-up, hardcore consequentialists make that just aren't accepted by a plurality of people, it seems to me.
But whenever there's some public crisis or the NHS, or any, and you say, which policy should we adopt? The one which saves the most people or less people? Everyone, you know, votes with their feet around, you know, a consequentialist policy. So if you look at judicial decisions in the UK, when it comes to people dying or killing. I mean, I just was talking about conjoined twins today, the Jodi Amer case. This was a case of killing one person to save another. The court even said that was what was happening. Lord Justice Ward said that. Now, when you're up against it, people do actually make consequentialist decisions. They are very reluctant to deviate from that.
If only, in certain circumstances, I would say, if only their instincts were along these lines. As somebody that cares very much about poverty, I wish people's first instinct were consequentialist about trying to save the most people. They, in fact, are not. They are more about, especially in my country, about individual liberty and choice and reaching a certain level of status in life. They're not, in fact, about consequentialist considerations about saving the most people. And in certain circumstances where we're talking, again, about, like, clinical trials and putting children in clinical trials or putting those who are in a sort of questionable moral state of being able to make choices in clinical trials that would save the most people, we tend to, again, err on the side of defending individual choice, individual liberty. Now, you might say that's for consequentialist reasons as well or something like that, and that's an interesting debate to have, but it seems to me not at all the case that most of our intuitions are consequentialists.
All right, we had one over here.
Okay, another question for Professor Sarescu about just trying to get some conceptual clarity about the way that the image of an embryo as a work of art was functioning in your argument. It doesn't necessarily strike me as a compelling image. So the question I suppose I have is, how far does the image run through, say, the life cycle of an embryo? So are the children who you're going home to tonight in the same relation to you as a painter is to his painting? Does that image follow through for you? So art is a projection of the will of the painter. If not, why not? That's the question, I suppose. Yeah. Just get some clarity.
Yeah. So I was responding to the so-called utilitarian position that the embryo or fetus has no value. Okay. Now, I think it's correct that there is no intrinsic value, but they can be instrumentally valuable. Now, when does a being come with its own moral status? That's the moral status debate. So, I think that Peter is incorrect about his estimate of the cognitive capacities of the newborn infant. I think studies have shown that the newborn infant has much higher cognitive capacities than was thought to have before. So for that reason, it's wrong, infanticide is wrong. My children have very high cognitive capacities. They're capable of, manipulating me in the same way as the other people are. So, that they are, at that point, you have a very significant leap in both kind of value and moral status. So in my view, the early embryo has instrumental value in the same way as a piece of art does. Now, some people claim that, pieces of art have intrinsic value. They certainly don't have a moral state. Well, some people would even claim they have a moral status. Some people claim the environment has a moral status. But I don't view them in that way. So the argument was that there can be sources of value apart from the moral status as a person. And those can ground some reasonable obligations on people not to destroy those things. And, I think that, people today seem to think there is absolutely nothing wrong with having an abortion. I'm suggesting, well, I used to think that, and now I think there is something wrong with it. But I don't think it's anywhere near as wrong as what pro-life people would think.
Okay, at this point in the format, we invite the two of you to expand a little more on your response to each other's points. So starting with Charles, if you'd like to take 5 or 10 minutes to kind of respond to Julian, and then we'll take more questions following that.
You're welcome to either use the podium or to sit where you are, whichever you're more comfortable with.
Sorry, if you just stay.
Yeah.
If you'd like to exchange a little bit about this, because I don't know if I'm going to talk for 10 minutes.
Yeah, I'm not going to talk for very long, because I think people have questions, so yeah. We should just...
So actually, building off what we were just saying, on what basis would you give a human being non-conditional value or intrinsic value? And at what age would this kick in, do you think?
Yeah, I think it occurs at some point, in after 20 weeks... of gestation, at 20 weeks, consciousness just begins. So Charlie has this view also about people in coma and so on. Now, people, we've redefined death to say it's now brain death, and indeed, courts have allowed the withdrawal of food and fluids and medical treatment from people who are permanently unconscious. So, if you think that life ends at a consciousness, it only begins in a morally significant sense at some point after consciousness begins. So, that certainly allows early abortion and destruction of embryos in terms of the moral status of the entity. So, I think myself that life begins after consciousness begins at some level of sophistication of consciousness, but not as far as Singer thinks. And I think it ends at some advanced diminution in consciousness. So people with advanced dementia who can no longer recognise other people, no longer engage with the world, who aren't yet fully unconscious, in my view, also have a life that's effectively ended in biographical terms, as I think James Roacher said.
So I can understand why someone with your point of view would say there's some significant moral status of a 20-week-old fetus, but I can't understand why it would be seriously wrong or even importantly wrong, any more wrong than to kill a pig because its flesh tastes good or something like that, right? Because pigs are far more mentally sophisticated than a fetus, or even if we give the newborn infant the benefit of the doubt that you wish. a pig is surely much more morally significant on just the actualized capacities basis than even a newborn infant. So I would say that either if that's true, then you need to, I don't know what your views on pigs are or on eating pig flesh, but there's got to be some way to explain that isn't just what Peter would call speciesism, right? I don't know if you want to talk about this for a while or if you want.
Please, you've got time to have a little discussion.
Okay. I have a couple other things I want to say, but maybe we want to. Do you want to play this out, or you want me to?
Well, I think this debate around killing non-human animals turns in large part around the sophistication of their mental lives and the sorts of now it's you need to set what the criteria are of a rich mental life, but then it's an empirical question how rich the pig's mental life is compared to a newborn infant's or a 20-week fetus. So if it turned out that pigs were geniuses and that they had this incredibly rich mental life, equally sophisticated as everyone here, it would be very wrong to be killing them. So I would agree with that. But, this turns on a number of empirical facts. Now, Peter, has a much greater grasp of those than I do, and I don't really want to engage in that debate because I haven't looked at how sophisticated is the life of a chimp compared to, a three-year-old child and so on. But that's where the debate really resides.
Yeah, and I don't want to. You haven't prepared for that, but I would just submit that as somebody who has thought about this, that nobody could possibly argue that a chimp has a less significantly moral life just based on their capacity.
But
than
I do think it's worse to kill an adult chimp than it is to destroy a human embryo. So yes,
what about a newborn infant?
Well, I think it's wrong to just. I mean, it's clearly. I mean, this is where I think the massive, massive conditional value, apart from the intrinsic value of killing a newborn infant, massively weighs. It makes it much worse to kill a newborn infant than it does to kill a chimp. It's just the case that so much hangs, on the lives of infants. Both intrinsically and instrumentally, that I think if Peter suggested that it would be better to kill an infant than a chimp,
if you don't take into account the potential, I actually agree with him. So like if I found out tomorrow that my argument for potential was wrong, I'd sort of agree with him and say, in fact, if we're looking at instrumental value or value to people, women have abortions for reasons that are often that are often based on data that aren't sufficiently available to them when they're pregnant. And so we might want to say that women should wait until they have the baby to determine whether or not to kill the child, if in fact these don't have intrinsic value and just have conditional value, or their intrinsic value is pretty small compared to their conditional value. Not every infant, of course, is valuable to their families. We have a 92% abortion rate of Down syndrome children in the United States. I don't know what it is here. But presumably that's an implication that not every child is of value to their families. And so if it is really about conditional value, I guess I would want to push and say, I think we should, if for the reasons that allow abortions for Down syndrome children, if we don't give the infant full non-conditional value, would apply to infanticide. I guess I disagree with Peter about that. A couple other points. First, I'm not sure that giving a prenatal child a full right to life solves the problem. I don't know if I heard you right. You said that, but I think you said that. Because I do think there are legitimate reasons to refuse to sustain people and to kill people in certain circumstances. So, in the United States anyway, we're very sympathetic with abortion remaining legal, but we're very skeptical of abortion for on demand. At least this is what the public policy polls say. So with regard to issues like abortion in the case of rape or abortion when a mother's or a woman's life or health is in danger, very sympathetic. And I think both of those can be justified even if you consider a fetus to be a person and have equal protection of the law. Because equal protection of the law does not mean you cannot be killed for any reason. We have all sorts of reasons that involve justified killing, particularly when self-defense is present, even against an aggressor that is not consciously making a decision to kill. If an insane person attacks you, you have the right to use violence, deadly violence in self-defense. And then if we take Thompson's violinist argument seriously, which I imagine many of you have heard before, not everyone has the duty to be sustained by another person, even if they are themselves a person. So I think we could talk, in Catholic moral theology, we talk about proportionate reasons to demand that someone sustain you. And then I think, especially in the case of non-consensual sex or rape, I don't think a woman has a proportionate duty to sustain, not a legal or moral duty to sustain. It would be sort of like a good Samaritan. And then, finally, at least for now, I often don't like it when conversations about abortion, which I'm really more concerned about surgical abortion, when they can get derailed into discussion about embryos, because I do think there are different questions to ask about embryos as opposed to questions about older prenatal children. In particular because it's not clear that, again, the definition of person in traditional Catholic moral theology is a substance of a rational nature, an individual substance of a rational nature. And it is not clear, to me at least, that embryos are in fact individual substances of a rational nature, given that they can twin and even recombine. So the discussion about the early embryo, I think, it's important to have when we talk about stem cell research and about IVF and about all these other things. But I think when it comes to abortion, I think it's sometimes not helpful because it skews the discussion. But even if we are talking about embryos, so I just said we shouldn't talk about it, let me say two things. This idea that they die at a high rate, I was one of the respondents to Toby Ord's article in the American Journal of Bioethics on this. And I said the first thing I just said, but then I also said, and some others pointed out, that we're not sure exactly what the failure rate is. So we're sure it's really high, and we're not sure if the embryos are fully fertilized or if they're failed fertilizations. So that's something we need to do more study on. And then even if the number is something like 50% or 60%, there are plenty of situations, unfortunately, throughout history where we've had 50% or 60% infant mortality, right? Presumably the fact that there was such a high mortality rate does not impinge on the moral status of such infants. It would just stand as its own as being a tragedy that we would, if we could, try to deal with. And I just want to say for the record, I know plenty of people that think that embryos are persons, they would never kill an abortionist, so.
I didn't understand that last point. So if suddenly infant mortality went up in the UK to 50%, there would be an absolute outcry. You know, everyone would be researching on how to reduce it. Not a single person in the UK is researching on how to reduce, you claim, the 50% embryo loss. And that tells us something about, implicitly, about how we value those two forms of life. So the fact that there was a historically unavoidable high infant mortality doesn't tell us anything about what would happen today if the infant mortality were 50%. And it's just a fact that most people don't view the loss of 50% embryos in the same way as they view the loss of 50% live-born infants.
And that's some data to include in our discussions, but throughout history, marginalized populations have always been disregarded by those in power, right? So infant mortality rates, even today, are far higher in populations of color than in white circumstances, right? And they're just not as taken seriously. Women's health has not been taken seriously throughout history when compared to men. I don't actually know what I think about the embryo. And actually, the Catholic Church's position is not that the embryo is definitely a person; it's that the embryo should be treated as a person because we don't know if embryos are persons. Just for the record, but for those who are convinced that it is a person, they see embryos as a marginalized population, one that is subject to authoritarian power structures which manipulate it for utilitarian value. As many other kinds of marginalized populations have experienced throughout history. And so just the fact that, I mean, they would not be surprised at all that if we found out today that embryos, and it isn't widely known, by the way, but if it were widely known and people did talk about it, it wouldn't be surprising at all to these individuals that people wouldn't be moved to act because they're part of this marginalized population that we don't give full consideration to.
Probably. Okay, shall we open up for some more questions at this stage? Yeah. So, Gina, you've been waiting for a while.
Someone had asked a bit about both of you about religious secular engagement, because I found it interesting, Julian, you were talking about in your initial presentation about the idea that on certain issues, on certain aspects of, say, discarded embryos or abortion for no particularly demanding reason, you might have cause to agree that there's a moral problem here. But it seems like just a total accident that you're agreeing. Right, because you completely disagree on the status of an embryo or a fetus. It's either something that has intrinsic value for a reason that may be rooted in a religious view about its nature, or it's instrumentally useful as a way of bringing utility to other people. And so it's just an accident that you end up agreeing by chance on certain matters of policy or of morality of individual actions. And I guess what I'm wondering is that the most we can aspire to here on this issue or certain other issues? Is that the extent of religious secular engagement? Sometimes, by chance, there'll be agreement on certain choices, and in those cases, we can stop fighting ideological wars. Or is there room for something more coming out of that, or some deeper, grander sort of engagement?
Well, you're exactly right. well spotted. I mean, when Peter Singer gave this talk to Charlie a year or so ago on Singer. What was it called? Christian Ethics Meets Singer. You know, there was I thought I said the only kind of really honest thing on behalf of utilitarians, because Peter was very happy to, and he is very happy to have Christians coming towards his views, because he wants to change the world and wants to bring about certain things. And I said, well, it's really a kind of superficial agreement, much as you described. Because at root, there's a difference in, and this is where I want to pick up the point that Charlie made about the faith of secular ethics and the faith of religious ethics, or at least fundamentalist religious ethics. And I think that, and Peter's not a good example of this, because I think he's very reluctant to give up certain things. But I think, other secular people are willing to sort of revise their values, to look at even their most basic values and argue how important should liberty be, or how important, what is well-being, how should it be constituted, and revise it. But when you get to more fundamentalist religious elements, those things cannot be questioned, because there's a direct connection with God or some authority text that we can't deviate from. So that severely constrains the revisability element of ethics. And I think that's what is very important. Now, many kind of people who are religious within this group are very happy to sort of to revise their own views, and they're loosely kind of Christian or Muslim or whatever. And I think that's where there's a possibility of some engagement. But, unless you think we've got all the right values at the moment and all the right principles, which would be incredible at this very immature time that we had, the most important value must be willingness to revise. And that's something that, there can be common ground between Christian and religious ethics, but, at the fringes of both of them, then there's very little prospect of progress. And that also applies to sort of fundamentalist atheists who, are very rooted in the sort of correctness of their values or their principles. So, I think there is scope for hope. But the hope resides in people's willingness to revise their moral beliefs and not in, actual convergence at the moment.
All right, anybody?
Do you mind if I respond to that same question? So, unsurprisingly, perhaps I have a more positive view about that. In particular, because I've engaged with Julian. So Julian, as many of you know, has this reputation with the bioethics community as precisely the person you can't have this kind of conversation with, right? And learning that that's just false is giving me lots of hope about this sort of thing. I mean, hearing what he had to say gave me hope about this sort of thing. But I think if we can get past, again, this is why it's so important to get our premises and line them up. If we can get past the debate about instrumental versus intrinsic value, which I think is very difficult to get past, one of the things we're trying to do in this paper we're writing together is talk about well-being. So even if we can just sort of jettison, and I don't think we should totally jettison, but even for the sake of argument, if we can jettison the debate about instrumental versus intrinsic value, can we talk about instrumental value alone and have some conversation about that? So So does the fact that we have abortion on demand virtually make our culture better? Does it make women better? Many pro-life feminists and even some not so pro-life feminists are skeptical about that, right? At least in our country, we have this refrain that even from most pro-choice individuals that abortion should be rare. It's not rare. There's 1.2 million abortions every year in the United States. So we have some sense, I do think, that even if we take a conditional approach rather than an intrinsic approach, we could find some ways of just talking together about is the kind of culture where we have 1.2 million abortions every year the kind of culture we want to live in, even if it's not a discussion about intrinsic value of fetuses and infants versus not. And I argue in the book, especially in the last two chapters, that I think utilitarianism is something that Christians and others can engage with. Utilitarianism comes out of Christian England, right? It doesn't come out of nowhere. The first utilitarians were all Christians. Sidgwick is a classic example. He ended up not being a Christian at the end of his life, but it comes out of Christian ethics. It would be shocking to any historian to say, well, we wouldn't expect to find any overlap between utilitarians and Christians, right? Given that utilitarianism comes precisely out of Christian England. And I try to highlight some of what I think are some overlaps. And I think a focus on intergenerational solidarity and a focus on future generations is precisely one of these things with regard to green issues and climate change and regard to poverty and these sorts of things. This is why I really do think that, especially with regard to poverty and intergenerational solidarity, there's tremendous overlap between Christian approaches and utilitarian approaches. And it would be surprising to me if we didn't find them.
Okay, we had a question over here in the second row. Yeah.
Thank you. The question is for Professor Savulescu, and it's about his idea of consciousness. Now, because he seems to be placing all the value on the possibility of a specificity in human race on consciousness. And I think that this is by no means clear. So I would like you, first of all, to define it, then to make sure that there's no other species that shares this consciousness, and then I would like you to tell us why we have to abide by this consciousness principle. Why? Because to me, you're ascribing it to it some sort of sacred value to it. What's the big deal about consciousness?
Well, I don't know what led you to believe that I thought only humans were conscious. I mean, there are many, many non-human animals that are conscious. I mean, cats are conscious, dogs are conscious, pigs are conscious, cows are conscious. They're all conscious.
So we shouldn't kill them?
Well, the question that is whether we are entitled to kill them and how we're meant to treat them. So traditionally the debate has been that it's wrong to kill self-conscious beings. So beings that are conscious, aware, able to understand their own existence and project desires into the future.
Many animals are self-conscious.
So that's exactly why Peter Singer and others have argued it's wrong to kill those kinds of animals. And I agree, if they're self-conscious, it is wrong to kill them. Now, how self-conscious a sheep is again, as I said before, an empirical question. Peter has shifted his view to saying that killing all non-human animals is wrong, to saying that killing animals in humane ways that doesn't cause suffering is now permissible. But, I mean, everyone agrees that the capacity to experience pleasure or to experience pain is something that's morally relevant, that animals shouldn't have suffering or pain inflicted on them.
And why self-consciousness is such a big value?
Well, as we were saying, that you have, unless you can find a sort of, you know, set of dictums that come from somewhere that, you know, absolutely, authoritatively tell you what's right and wrong, you have to proceed in what John Rawls called a pattern of reflective equilibrium. You have to start with some principles, you have to start with some values, and you revise them in light of trying to get them all into the maximum pattern of coherence and consistency. Now, there's nothing that, I mean, some environmentalists claim that everything is a value. You know, a rock is a value, and, you know, the environment's a value. Now, you know, there's nothing you can say to that, except to say this leads to these logical consequences, it's inconsistent with these things that you do, and so it would seem that, the value that you put in that way is inconsistent with other things. Now, there isn't, unless you think there's some foundational set of truths, which many religions do hold, but for those of us who aren't persuaded by that, it's a piecemeal process of removing planks and, you know, trying to understand why is it that we can kill some animals but not others, what's right or wrong about killing or farming animals.
In other words, the status is perfectly arbitrary. It's principle status, and so it is arbitrary.
Well, when you say arbitrary, it's invented by human beings, but so are our laws. Our laws are arbitrary in that way, and everything about human life is arbitrary in your sense. It couldn't but be arbitrary unless there was some God that made it non-arbitrary. And I don't want to get into arguments about the existence of God and so on. So, you know, everything will be arbitrary in the sense that you're discussing.
Okay, so we hear from somebody else who's got... Yeah, okay, over there.
At least in the US, abortion training for people in medical school is optional. And... excuse me. In a lot of rural states, especially, where you might have to drive to a big city to find a doctor who would do an abortion, even in the case of rape or incest, some have argued presents an undue burden for patients. And even in these states, that personhood bills have been recently proposed. Several doctors that I've talked to are more worried that there will not be doctors who are trained in this procedure in the future than there are that this legislation will actually change. So I was wondering, Professor Sevenlisky, if you thought that it is a moral obligation to let the students undergo this training.
Well, I've written on how conscientious objection is immoral in states, jurisdictions where abortion is legal and it's a part of a medical system. And I don't think that it's... I think it's quite reasonable for... to require people who enter obstetrics and gynaecology to undergo training in abortion and to take their fair share of abortion processes. Because if you don't want to do that, you should become a haematologist or a cardiologist or whatever. And so, you know, I've argued that it's a violation of people's autonomy, it's an unjust use of community resources, and people do have an obligation to offer what is seen as a medical procedure and that's legal. And that when your own personal moral objections means that people are denied that service, then, you know, that should be corrected. I mean, to take more extreme examples, there are studies of the UK where people... students of certain religious orientations refuse to examine patients of the opposite sex. Mm-hmm. Now, it seems to me if you don't want to examine patients of the opposite sex, you shouldn't enter medicine. You should choose another profession. So, you know, I think there are limits to conscientious objection, and, you know, those limits should be that they don't impair the working of a healthy system. So, and I think there's abundant evidence that is occurring with conscientious objection.
I just want to mention that at any given point, the standard of care for any particular medical field seems to be, I would say, arbitrary. So currently we understand in many situations abortion to be part of the standard of care that these sorts of physicians should come to, or some of us do. But that's an open question. I mean, precisely in the American context, it's an open question, precisely because many abortions don't seem to be addressing a medical issue at all. In fact, the overwhelming majority of them do not address a medical issue at all, either for the fetus or for the mother. And so the example I thought of was, you know, what about neonatologists? It isn't currently the standard of care, except in perhaps some places in the Netherlands, that we would do infanticide, right? But I can imagine Peter Singer or others who deny the argument for potential that it should be, for the same reasons that abortion is part of the standard of care for OB. But that just, I mean, the standard of care then is just something that shifts with the current culture's understanding of these kinds of questions that we're arguing about. So it sort of begs the question just to say, well, it's the standard of care, it should be done. And that's not what you were saying, but that's often the kind of argument that I hear. So that's that's something that I would want to challenge as something that's almost completely arbitrary in terms of how these arguments play out in any given social situation.
I'll just say one thing quickly about this. It makes a difference whether it's a private or a public health system, because I think in a private system, you can say what you're going to do and what you're not going to do. And as long as you openly advertise that and people realise you're not a person who does euthanasia or you're not a person who does abortion, that's fine. In a public health system, you're employed to do a job. And if the job changes, you're still employed to do that job. And if you don't like the job, you get another job. And I worked as a doctor. You see many people who abuse themselves, who attempt suicide, who repeatedly cut themselves, abuse themselves with alcohol, take drugs, kill people in accidents drunk. And you think, morally, you know, I disapprove of treating this person, or I disapprove of this person's behaviour and so on. But your job is to treat them, regardless. And that's what you're paid to do as a part of a public health system. So the place of moral discussion and moral agreement is not at the bedside, it's at a different level. Now, it's fine to say people who get cirrhosis of the liver from drinking alcohol shouldn't get liver transplants, but it's not your job as an individual doctor to say, I'm not going to put you on the waiting list because I disapprove of your alcohol intake. But that's precisely what happens in the abortion debate, in a public system. And so here I'm talking about more of the UK, where it does happen.
Do you think neonatologists in a public system in the Netherlands should be forced to do infanticides?
Well, if that's what is judged by that community to be a standard of medical care, yes. So if you don't want to do, if you don't want to, so
don't be a neonatologist if you don't want to kill.
No. But you kill people all the time as neonatologists when you withdraw their breathing tube or you withdraw their feeding tube. So you could equally say, well, pro-lifers could come into neonatology and say, I really want to look after babies, but I'm never going to limit their medical treatment. I'm never going to withdraw their feeding tube. I'm never going to withdraw their ventilation tube, regardless of how dismal their prognosis is. Those people shouldn't be neonatologists. And that's a part of neonatology is already killing babies. It's killing babies by removing the treatment that's keeping them alive. Yeah. Now, if you're not prepared to do that, you shouldn't enter neonatology. You should enter another profession.
I agree, we have a lot of incoherence there.
So we've got time for one more question. So if somebody wants to go.
Yeah, Professor Zawaleski, I was wondering if you could expound and clarify on exactly what determines moral status. Because it seems as though life, which is very much understood through cognition as a determinant of that, and you've said that dementia could be understood as a less of a value of life because of lacking that cognition. So I'm curious then with regard to infants and children where their cognitive abilities are still developing, if in a sense there's less moral value upon that being, because if not, it seems like we might be then reverting to an argument of potentiality about their developing cognitive abilities.
Yeah, I mean, you can take a scalar or a threshold view of moral status. So on a scalar view, and clearly the fetus, the newborn infant's, you know, cognitive capacities are steadily increasing, you might say, well, so their moral status is. Mm-hmm. Most people accept what's called a threshold view of moral status. You cross some threshold and then you have, you know, it's wrong to kill. So, you know, on my view, it's a question of the sophistication of the social interaction and social responses and the sophistication of the responses and interaction with the environment and the ability to process information. So although a human infant, you know, appears to be quite retarded compared to a pig, in fact, I think there's quite a lot of evidence that the infant is interacting in a very sophisticated way with its environment. And although it's not clearly as rational or cognitively able as an adult human being, it seems to me, again, we should give the newborn infant the benefit of the doubt. And when it comes to advanced Alzheimer's disease, the sort of people, you know, the sort of stage I'm talking about is where you're unable to recognise yourself or even other people. A newborn infant very quickly can recognise its mother as opposed to, you know, other people. So, you know, it's able to process and learn very quickly. So that's, you know, it's true, it's increasing, but it also already has quite sophisticated cognitive life. So I think it is about cognitive life. I'm not sure that I would say it's about rationality in the way that we've been talking, the way that Peter talks about it. But I think that's a value that's up for grabs, and it's something that, you know, I started off with this Peter Singer, Michael Tooley view in my own mind. It's self-consciousness, it's rationality, that sort of thing. And I've gradually shifted that. But here's an example where we could have a debate around what kind of mental life distinguishes us from the other non-human animals, at what point does the human achieve it, and what point does the human lose it. So we're talking about the kind of where the line is drawn at the periphery, which is important. But that's not where the debate is when it comes to people who have sort of fundamentalist positions. They're not talking about at what point does what capacities are important and what aren't. They're talking about pure potential. And I was struck by Charlie's claim that the fetus is a rational substance. I mean, the fetus, at least an 8-week fetus, is no more rational than an embryo, and both of them are just potentially rational substances. So I can't see how you can draw a difference between an early fetus and an embryo in terms of its rational cognitive capacities, not even conscious at 9 weeks. So, I think that, there are important debates still to be had, lots of things where we may change our views. But I think there are some positions that there's just no hope for convergence on. But do you want to, you should have the last word.
Well, I don't know about that. But so I think it's tough because if you set the threshold, if you take the threshold view of moral status and you set it too high or pretty high, you end up with counterintuitive positions about the kinds of examples you mentioned. So children, mentally disabled, all the other kinds. But then if you try to set it low, which I was really surprised to hear Julian say 20 weeks, I guess, then you, in my view anyway, you open up full moral status to a huge range of non-human animals that would have really counterintuitive implications for ways of interacting in the world that we haven't even really thought about yet, it seems to me. So that's not a reason not to have the threshold view, but it's certainly one of the puzzles, it seems to me, of trying to have it.
All right, before we thank the speakers,
have a great dinner.
I'll see you tomorrow.
I will just say that we have the second debate tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. It won't be held here. It's going to be held in the Radcliffe Humanities Building, the new building, which is just a few doors up Woodstock Road. It's at 4 o'clock. And you don't need to register for that one. You are welcome to come along to that. So I hope many of you will join us for that. Just remains to say, please stick around for a few minutes, have a glass of college wine, and for those of you who are on the list for dinner, we'll then shortly be walking over to El Shami for dinner. And it only remains to thank Professor Camosi for his contribution to the debate.